Y'all, I just finished Author Accelerator's book coaching course and submitted my materials, and let me tell you, I learned a ton. If you've been listening for a while, you know I spent 5 years as an editor with the New York Times, but I still had a lot to learn about helping writers through the process of taking a book from idea to manuscript, and I loved learning it with the Author Accelerator team. What they taught me has changed my approach to editing completely. I didn't just learn how to help a writer move from one stage of the process to the next. I learned how to help them appreciate how far they've come and feel excited about what's coming next, see their strengths and how they can build on them, and trust me to guide them into the hard work that lies ahead. If you'd like to learn more about coaching, fiction or nonfiction, then you need to visit www.bookcoaches.com to learn more.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay! Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. Try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause.
I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3. Okay.
Hey, this is Jess Leahy, and you are listening to the hashtag AmWriting podcast. This is the podcast where we talk about all things writing, short things, long things, queries, book proposals, poems, although we don't do that very often and we really should fix that. Short stories, fiction, all the things. And more than anything else, though, this is the podcast about getting the work done. I'm Jess Leahy. I'm the author of The Gift of Failure and The Addiction Inoculation, and I've written for The Atlantic and The New York Times and The Washington Post for a long time, and you can find my work there. And today I have a guest I'm super excited about, because my guest today was nice to me before I ever did any of those things. In fact, when I was writing a book early on called The Education of a Flatlander that never got published because, I don't know, I think nobody's first book really should be published because it was terrible. I've told this story before, but he was just really nice to me, and he had no reason to go out of his way to be nice to me. But since then, I have found that this person is known as just a nice guy in writing. AJ Jacobs is with me today. His name has come up often in the podcast, and we're going to be talking about his book that is coming out on April 26th called The Puzzler. And if you know anything about me, about KJ, about my mother-in-law, who is a New York Times crossword puzzle aficionado, you know that this book is a big deal to me. AJ, welcome to the show.
I'm so excited to be here. As you know, I'm a big fan of you, of your writing, of your podcast, and I think you are a nice person in publishing. Very nice.
I have to tell you, what the reason you come up is that whenever I'm thinking about, do I have time to respond to this new writer that's asking for advice, I do the what would AJ do, and I tend to respond
if at all possible. Very nice.
So,
see?
Yeah, you are my model for writers helping writers. And you've actually had, we're going to talk about all kinds of stuff. We're going to talk about the book. As AJ knows, this is a podcast where we do talk about the really dorky stuff pretty in depth. I do want to talk, though, about being nice to other writers and helping other writers, because you've had some people that have worked, interned with you in the past who have gone on to become like super skilled writer, journalist people in their own right. So I have to ask a little bit, because you don't hear about that many. We've never talked about this on the show, about writers having interns. So could you talk a little bit about that practice and sort of how that has worked for you in the past? And you know, when you get to stand there like the proud daddy and look at some of those writers that have gone out into the world and done
amazing
things.
Well, I know. It's one of my favorite stories. And the one guy I'm thinking of in particular is so much more successful than me. It's fantastic. What happened was, this was many years ago. I was writing the book, The Year of Living Biblically. And this kid, he was a freshman at Brown, where I went to college, and he said, I want to be a professional writer, which already I was like, is that really a wise idea? but he said, I would love to come and be your assistant and work for free over the summer and be a barista in the spare time. And I was like, all right. I actually, in the Year of Living Biblically, I tried to follow the rules as literally as possible. And one of the more offensive rules is that sort of biblical slavery is a thing and is allowed. So I was like, I guess this, you know, internship can be the closest thing. He came, he was wonderful, did great research, made Ezekiel bread. And as a thank you to him, I took him on one of my trips, because I go on these trips for my books to embed myself. And we went to...
Your trips. We have to talk about that at some point, because your trips are the best
thank
trips.
You,
they're really good.
So we went to Jerry Falwell's church in Lynchburg, Virginia. And he was fascinated. And he, on the way back, said to me, what if I transfer from Brown, which is where he was, one of the most liberal schools, and spend a semester at Liberty, which is Jerry Falwell's church, like, which is the most conservative, you know, no kissing, no R-rated movies. It's just, and I said, that is a really interesting idea. And he wrote the
Well, interesting and really risky. I mean, Brown and Liberty University, like, was he visiting? Was he like all in? Did he transfer like all in? It's amazing to me the full immersion he was willing to do as a college student.
So yeah, very brave. He wrote a proposal. I helped him. I connected him with my agent, and he got the deal. And he went down there, and it's a wonderful book.
I love the book.
It's a great book, Unlikely Disciple. And I like it too, because it's not he's not making fun of them. He's just trying to understand what is good, what is bad. So it's a very open-minded book. But anyway, he has gone on to be super successful. He's now a columnist for the New York Times. So I have to tell you, like, sometimes being nice is like, you know, good for, it's very like.
And who are we talking about? AJ is like violating the very first rule of promoting other writers.
Oh,
AJ,
my God.
What's
did I forget
name?
His name? All right. Kevin Roos. Everybody read Kevin Roos. He's written a couple of books and he writes a fantastic column about tech. And yeah. he's fighting the evil of Facebook. And yeah, I'm a big fan. So I actually don't use that many interns. I do because I love to do my own research. I find mm-hmm. that when I'm doing research, it'll take me down unexpected alleys that I couldn't do if I outsourced it. Do you ever use interns?
I have paid interns. I've paid people to do something that, you know, when you get to the end of a book and you're so sick of it that you would just light it on fire, that is not the moment in which you would like to write the book discussion group guide for your book. So I have outsourced it twice, once to a writer who came and met me at an event in California, who was a fan of my work and wanted to write a book like The Gift of Failure, but oriented towards sports. And I was like all in. I'm like, you so need to write that book. It'd be great. I'd love to read that book. And so I said, a couple months later, I said, I know you know the war, you know the book, and you're trying to break into writing. So obviously, I'd like to pay you. Would you help me with this book discussion thing? And then actually, I hired a college student on the second book to write the addiction inoculation. And so that's been really great because I always thank them and I mention it, you know, my editor knows who did it and it's always really done well done. And so I try to talk them up as much as possible. So anyway, that's been really helpful.
That
but
is
no,
very
I,
smart.
I'm a huge fan of those, like, you're doing the research and you stumble on something that you didn't expect and that starts a whole new thing. And this is something I've talked about as a teacher that is the problem with being able to too thinly slice and ask a very specific question of Google because, you know, if you're asking really specific questions for your research and you get the answer, you're like, oh, check, done. So with my students, I would let them do electronic research for their book reports on, let's say they're doing a history report on like clothing construction in the whatever, the French Revolution, whatever. For the first little bit, I do ask them to use physical books because there's something about that like reading an encyclopedia, as you well know, reading that kind of stuff, you know, all of a sudden you learn all kinds of new things and you say, oh, wait, that should be its own chapter, where you never would have come on that topic if you hadn't done the research yourself.
Absolutely.
So handing that over to someone else seemed counterproductive to me.
Agree. And also talking to people. I mean, that to me, it's like when I talk to people, they tell me about something or tell me about someone else and I talk to them. And so, yeah, the more people you talk to, the more of these unexpected avenues open up.
Well, and I think as someone, as an interviewer, you are fun to talk to because because you're naturally curious. And I was talking to, you can tell when an interviewer is naturally curious and when they're just trying to get the job done. And you talk to all kinds of cool people in the research for your book. And I think that sort of opens people up to having conversations that they might not naturally have. And that's part of the fun.
Like, that is a great
It's in, whether it's in like The Puzzler or whether it's in The Year of Living Biblically, or, you know, I have this very, very specific memory in, The Healthiest Man in the World? Is it healthiest? Is that the right word?
Exactly.
Okay. When you were being
Not that. I forgot the name of my own book. It's called Drop Dead Healthy. But at one point it was called The Healthiest Man in the World. And we can talk about titles if you want.
Oh my gosh, titles. It was, I know it was called that because that's the version that stuck in my head first. Anyway, and there was this really lovely moment where you were being taught how to appreciate one blueberry. And it was just this really lovely moment that couldn't have happened if you hadn't gone there, which in COVID times makes things difficult, but couldn't have happened if you hadn't gone there. It's this moment that really sticks out. Like when I'm eating, sometimes I think about that blueberry. Like, how do I savor this thing and really taste my food?
I think about it all the time too. And yeah, they took it to the extreme. They were like, we tried to eat it took 15 minutes to eat one blueberry. So it was out of control. But I do agree with the idea of savoring and really mindful eating, I guess they call it. But yeah, I love that. And I love what you said about interviewing, because I do try. I try to be interesting to the person I'm talking to, which I find, first of all, you know, they're doing me a favor by talking. So I've got to bring something to the table. And also, I think it just makes them open up more if you can say, I just visited the CIA. Have you heard about, this puzzle called Kryptos? And they're in the puzzle community, so they're already interested.
So a question about, we're just jumping right in, obviously. For the listeners who know that I have not done my job very well right now, we are talking about the book The Puzzler that will be out on April 26th. It's fantastic. AJ has written The Year of Living Biblically and a whole bunch of other. For me, I've read all of your books. I was a fan before we ever got in touch, and I think for me, that full immersion life as an experiment. And I wanted to ask, actually, do you have any problems with the term stunt journalism?
I'm okay with it. I mean, there are a lot of names for this genre. Yeah. There's immersion journalism, sounds a little classier, method journalism, but stunt journalism. I mean, to me, it's all about the way you frame it because, these are stunts living by the Bible for a year. But, painting a huge mural on the ceiling of a church, that's kind of a stunt. So Michelangelo, he was a stunt painter. Not that I'm comparing myself to, I guess I am comparing myself to Michelangelo.
I don't like the term stunt journalism only because I tend to think of it as learning journalism or student journalism or beginner's mind journalism, because the thing that's so appealing about your work or Bill Bryson's work or anyone who does this sort of, I'm going to do this thing and write about it and I'm not afraid to look dumb. A friend of mine, Jim, has a YouTube channel, and he did what I think is one of the bravest things, which is he went into it as a beginner beekeeper. He knew almost nothing, and he had all these big ideas about what he was going to do, and he was not afraid to capture on camera. In fact, there's one moment where he really screwed up, and he wasn't going to put it on the YouTube channel, but then he's like, no, I really have to put this up because I don't want other people to make the same mistake. Fast forward to now, where he's got an incredibly popular channel. He's designing his own things he calls bee barns, these really well-insulated bee barns where he's got humidity and temperature sensors embedded in the boxes and blah, 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 and he's become an expert. But what I so respect is that ability to say, learn with me. I'm going to do this thing. I'm going to screw it up. And I want you to learn along with me. And for me, that is the sweet spot of writing for me. Like if I can read a book and learn along with someone who's equally curious, I think that's...
Absolutely.
I think that's just the best books ever.
I echo that 100%. And I love the idea of, being vulnerable and learning along the way. As one of my favorite authors, Jess Leahy, talks about in The Gift of Failure.
Which is in your book, AJ.
I know.
You put it in your book. I yelled out loud. My husband was across the house. And I said, AJ put me in his book. I was so excited.
Oh, it was a delight to be in there. You and Angela Duckworth. And I was very excited. Because the book is a lot about, puzzles are all about failure. I mean, failure, you have to fail and fail and fail and fail. But I agree that in writing, the failure is often what's most interesting. And like in this book, I went to the World Jigsaw Puzzle Championships, and I came in second to last with my family. It was a huge failure. But I think that's more interesting than...
The best chapter in the whole book.
Thank you, Jess.
Julie getting pissed off at the monkeys and the t-shirts. The facts that your kid... Okay, I even wrote down, kids didn't fight over placement of last piece. Because I was proud of them. You won. You won right there. You do realize that. Like, the Russians may have killed it with their puzzle. No pun intended. It's a bad time to be talking about the Russians taking the win. But...
Right.
So for those who, I will not spoil much here, but AJ does find out that there is no one entered as the Team USA for the international puzzling jigsaw puzzle competition. First of all, like how there was no one else entered, I don't know, because I knew this was a thing. So how there's no Team USA, how is that even possible?
It is bizarre. It was the very first year of this tournament, so I think that people just didn't know about it. But now... Well, they're doing another one, and there's going to be hundreds of Americans trying
out.
That's
so cool.
So I slipped in while I could.
The fact that you got your kids to be a part of it, always good. In fact, if we have time, we're going to be talking about what we've been reading recently. And the reason that I have this super dorky other book on my desk right now is because my kid read it, and I just wanted to be able to talk to him about that book. So we will do just about anything to get our kids to talk to us, I suppose. But I also wanted to bring up that there is a tool that you use in this book, not as much as in some of your other books, like Living Biblically uses this tool quite a bit, this technique quite a bit. And that is the befuddled / mystified / condescending / mocking spouse. Bill Bryson does it to great effect in his books. He has a spouse who sort of looks at him. It's the looking at you and rolling your eyes kind of thing. Julie has been a force of eye rolling in your books over time, but it was also really great to see her get swept up in the puzzle challenge.
Oh, she was all in. Yeah, she was all in. She was not skeptical. She was hardcore. And it's a hard tournament. It's 8 hours, and you have to solve 4 puzzles, each of over 1,000 pieces. And she made a pledge not to use the bathroom for 8 hours, no breaks. And to me, that was like one of the nicest things she's ever done in our marriage. It was amazing. But yeah, I definitely, the eye-rolling character, which is funny because she's always had it, but now it's almost like she's grown into the role. She's become more eye-rolling. She's like, she knows what she's expected to do. But she, I agree. You need to have, it's important. That's a good tool to have because it's a good stand-in for the reader or the
right
saying, what the hell is going on? But at the same time, you don't want anyone to be one note because no one is black and white.
Right.
Everyone is full of nuances. Another lesson.
You need someone. Yeah. Well, it's like in films when you need to have like, I was watching, what were we watching recently? Oh, the Facebook movie. And they've got like an attorney sitting there and she gets to ask questions of Mark Zuckerberg so that he has to explain things to her. And, you need to fit that exposition in there somewhere. And I think the audience, I don't think I'd be doing my job if every once in a while the audience wasn't looking at me and saying, is she taking this too far? What's going on here? And so, it's a good stand-in for our audience. But I love that she's... Plus, it's I expect that she's going to be there, and I like it when she shows up.
I will tell her. She will be delighted.
So a couple things I would love to talk about as I read this book. I just devoured it. I absolutely loved it, mainly because I think you and I are about the same age. I'm 51. How old are you?
I'm 53. So about, if you're being kind.
So you and I were both obsessed with like the big moment for me when I realized you got to talk to Kit Williams, because Masquerade, the book Masquerade, was I was obsessed, totally obsessed, and have listened to all every podcast I can find about it, have listened to everything I can, because I just always wanted to know how it turned out. So the fact that you got to talk to Kit Williams was like,
that is so
up there in the stratosphere.
I am so happy that you love that book. And just for those who are not our age or are not obsessed, it's this gorgeous book that came out, I think, in 1981. He's a painter, and it's illustrated. And it's got this crazy imagery of rabbits dancing and the sun. And the theme of the book is that within those beautiful paintings and the sort of the weird poetry are clues to a hidden buried treasure, a real treasure, a rabbit, a golden rabbit somewhere in England. And it just set off this mania in England and in the U.S., millions of people. And for over a year, people were just digging up gardens, you know, trespassing, looking for this golden.
Well, it endured for years because, you know, there's something in the human condition about wanting to solve things that's just, and, you know, at the heart of your book, it's that, you know, creating an answer out of chaos, creating order out of chaos, or coming up with the one answer that's correct, and which is what's so maddening about the solution to Masquerade, which is A, there was some cheating involved, and B, there were two guys who actually did solve it before Cheater Guy, and they just didn't get there first. But they were the real winners. And
that is true. That is true. Yeah. But I will say, just in defense of Masquerade, because part of the lessons that I'm trying to impart to myself, especially, is, you know, enjoying the journey. So even if you don't get to that solution, like, just the joy of trying to solve this gorgeous puzzle. And I never solved it, of course. But it did inspire me. As part of the marketing of this book, I have inserted a secret puzzle in the book, a secret code. And if the reader solves it, it's sort of a password to the website, the puzzlerbook.com website, and that will open up an actual contest with a $10,000 prize, which is not as much as the golden rabbit, but it's not nothing.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. No, it's really amazing. Okay. So let's vacillate wildly between cool little bits of information that I'm so excited to talk about and the stuff our listeners come here for, which is things like, so when you wrote the proposal for this book, we talk a lot about proposals because I think they're the most horrifying thing on the planet and the best thing on the entire planet for actually getting at the heart of what your book is before you actually have to sit down and write your book. When you wrote the proposal for The Puzzler, which I'm assuming you had to do, or are you just so amazing now?
No, I did. I did a proposal.
So do you make discoveries along the way that then change the content? You know, obviously in doing the research, you know, things come up, but how much of the book do you think actually ends up looking like your proposal? And this can be open to any of your books. Like, The Addiction Inoculation was probably 90% there, because I spent a whole year and a half on the proposal for Addiction Inoculation. But Gift of Failure, I'd say it was my first book. I learned so much along the way that it was really different, I think, from what I had proposed in the first place.
Yeah.
So for you,
I would
rate?
Say I'm in between those. I'm probably 60, 50%. I mean, part of what I think is good for the reader is when you make discoveries, so you don't want to have it all planned out. You want to be able to go down these little routes. But this book actually came about in an odd way, because I was researching. I had a contract for a totally different book, and I spent 3 months researching it. And it's actually still a book that a topic I think is interesting. It was all about what's true in this allegedly post-truth world. Like, how do I know that the world is round? How do I know Julie, my wife, loves me?
Oh my gosh, I would so read the shit out of that.
Maybe I'll still write it. But I was actually miserable while researching it. And part of the reason was I didn't know how to structure it. It was such a big topic. And I emailed this to you before the show. I'm addicted to structure. I love, my first book was about reading the encyclopedia, and I just knew chapter A, chapter B, chapter C.
Yeah.
And, you know, interesting stuff from the A section of the encyclopedia woven in with my life. So I didn't have a structure. And so 3 months.
That's a hard one.
Yeah, the truth
that's a
one.
Hard topic to get into a.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I came up with like 10 different ideas, but none of them were gelling. And finally, my agent said, maybe just do something fun that you love. And I've always loved puzzles, as you know, from Masquerade. And I said, well, what if I did devote a year or two to just my passion and seeing why I love it and how it's good for us, if at all. And also the structure was so easy because there are all these different genres of puzzles. Crosswords, my first love, but there's jigsaws, Rubik's, and all of these genres I knew so little about, like Japanese puzzle boxes, which turns out to be it's like a cult of people who spend thousands of dollars. It's sort of secretive and delightful. So yeah, the structure was very clear right from the start, and I loved the topic, so I dove in. But yes, the proposal did not have a lot of these genres that I didn't even know much about.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the fun of it. And it took me a while to figure out that my editor didn't actually think that the resulting book was going to look exactly like what we'd submitted in the first place, no matter how many times my agent was like, no, it really needs to look something like what you submitted in the first place. But okay, so we have a meta question here, because you were talking about, okay, take some time off from the thing that's confounding you and do some puzzles or do the book on puzzles, or in your case, or in my case, sometimes doing a puzzle or doing something that's analogous to a puzzle. For me, it's weeding. And I wrote this down as I was writing, because when I'm really, really stuck when I'm writing, and it happens to be summer, there is a weed that I encounter on my property here and back in New Hampshire called Bishop's weed. And Bishop's weed has a very discreet, solid stem that goes really, really deep and gets tangled in other things. And there's something incredibly meditative about untangling those roots from whatever it is I'm trying to untangle it from. And getting is because the thing about this root is if you leave any little bits of root left, like if you just chop it up, you'll have 1,000 plants instead of just the one that you were dealing with. And I have solved so many writing problems while untangling those roots with my fingers. So I'm curious, did writing this big puzzle, this book about puzzles, help you at all sort of take your mind off of the sort of get out of the weeds with, so to speak. With the, I really didn't plan that, with the, with the truth book? And is, you know, by putting that book on simmer, has that helped at all? Are you anywhere further along with that book? Or do you think you might return to it because you were able to take your brain off of it for a little while?
Well, first of all, I want to come to your house and weed with you because that sounds very satisfying.
Good. Yeah.
I just want to echo what you said about taking a break. And that I talk about that in my book because there's lots of science on how when you take a break from a problem, whether it's a writing problem or else, you come back and you have a fresh perspective. And it's not a new insight. Leonardo da Vinci, I quote him talking about how he would walk away from his paintings and come back. So that was really crucial. And I did that a lot with the puzzle book. Perhaps too much, because I always had, that's the problem with researching something you love that much.
Yeah.
Like I could always tell myself, oh, I'm researching and just spend the whole day doing puzzles. So that was dangerous.
Right. Yeah.
It's interesting.
I can see that.
I haven't even returned to the truth book yet, but Now that you mention it, I am going to see if taking that big break has helped at all. Because, yeah, if anything, if there's any way to get through it, that's it. I needed to take a break.
I actually, oddly enough, have a book I finished the proposal for. My agent has seen it. My agent and I have edited it. It's close to done, like really close to done. And while we were working on that, I had an idea for something I was more excited about. And that has really pulled my attention. So I haven't touched the proposal for the first thing that I'm a little, like, I still like it, but I'm a little less excited about it than I am this other thing. And I, KJ and I talk about this a lot. Is that just sort of shiny object syndrome? Or is that something you should listen to? And in this case, I happen to think it's something I should listen to. That's my intuition says. So
do you think you'll ever get back? Yeah. Do you think you'll ever get back?
Yeah, I still like it. Yeah, right. I still like it. I think it's a good idea. I think it's a good book. There's a hole in the market, and yeah, I'd be happy to fill that hole. But, you know, I don't know. We'll see what happens. So I have a very important question. there's a division in my marriage about the way we approach, and now Wordle has come out since you finished this book. So
right. I was Wordle, able to slip in the word Wordle. So I got. Yeah. I can say that my book contains Wordle. Literally, yeah. It just says Wordle. Like, I love puzzles.
Are you a Wordle person?
I do.
Okay. Do you have a first entry strategy?
Well, that's interesting because I did a bunch of research on Wordle. First of all, I love the Wordle spinoffs. There must be like 6,000.
Do you know about the Shakespeare one?
No, that's
can't
great.
Remember. So, and I tweeted about it a while ago, but it's actually a word from Shakespeare. It's done by Folger, the Folger Library. And when you finish it, you can actually click on a link and it'll show you where that word comes from in Shakespearean literature. And
it's
pretty cool. I really like that one. And it's escaping me at the moment what it's called. I'll look it up.
Well, that's much more highbrow than the ones I, Loodle, where it's L-E-W-D-L-E.
Good.
Like naughty words. And Taylordle for Taylor Swift related words, like John Mayer, her ex-boyfriend. But yeah. I read an article about a guy who designed an AI that figured out the best first word. So when I do go, sometimes I just try to break it up, just do a random word to make it more interesting. But the word that according to my research, is best is soar, S-O-A-R-E, a young hawk.
I saw that too. Now that's what you play?
That is often what I play.
My rule is it has to be whatever five-letter word comes to my head first. So like
that's better. Yeah.
Whatever, and the problem is sometimes they're really terrible. Like it could be, you know, a Q-U, it could be whatever. So, but that's my, Swerdle. And Loodle. That's good.
Interesting.
I'm looking up the Shakespeare one. Anyway, so mine is I have to play whatever my first word is. But here's where the division in my marriage comes from. Do you ever just say, I don't care about finishing today and walk away? Because I do. Like, I can just decide, I don't feel like doing this anymore. I'm going to walk away. It could be the B, which we definitely all play Wordle every day for a while there as a family, not like together, but we all did the B every day. My husband tries to play the pangram first. Like he likes for that to be his first word. I saw in the book, you know, your 4 a.m. attempts to get the pangram. Don't turn your phone on at 4 a.m. when you go to PAJ. That's just a bad idea.
I agree. Listen,
so,
I know.
Anyway, so can you walk away? Like, I am perfectly happy getting three words in on Wordle and saying, I got to go cook dinner. I don't care. And then,
well, that is a great skill. And that is, I talk about this tension in the book because there's the tension between just embracing the joy of puzzles and then the obsession with finishing and getting to that end point. And I think we need more people like you in this world who can just embrace and
my husband's horrified. He's like, how can you do that? You haven't finished. Like,
no, it's good.
Stop.
It is. I mean, that is the sign of an evolved and flexible mind. I'll tell you, I don't know if you saw this part. I can't remember whether I added it really late. It was this guy who spent the pandemic trying to break the world's records for assembling the largest jigsaw puzzle ever. and no one had solved it yet. It's 54,000 pieces. It's of all these famous paintings. So he spent months doing it. He got up to 53,999, and that last piece was missing.
And that's a nightmare.
He just
freaked out.
He said, yeah, he lost sleep. He was moved everything in his apartment, checked the vacuum clean. You know, this is like, yeah, it's the puzzle nightmare. But I kind of wanted him to be, you know what? It's okay. Like sort of exposure response prevention.
It's not okay. It's not. It's like as a person who can walk away from Myrtle and to be that
is too much. All right. Well, he luckily pleaded his case, and the Jigsaw Puzzle Company sent him a replacement piece. So all is okay.
I actually moved some rugs around during COVID. I ran out of things to do during COVID. So at one point, I, you know, moved the rugs around in my house, found two puzzle pieces that had been gnawed on by cats underneath, because the cats find it really fun to get up on the table and use their paw to like put them on the ground. And then the dogs or the cats will then find them and chew on them. So it's a really, KJ actually told me about a tray with drawers in it that you can do the puzzle on. And so I got that from my mom. She left it here last time she was here, and you can stick them in there, and it's mostly cat proof, unless the cat's really
That is
inventive.
A good tip. But yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It works really well. And clearly you could have used something like that at the puzzle championships. It sounds like people came with there are like accoutrements that you could have for this puzzle thing. Having to open the film on the box with your hands. I mean, come on.
Was not prepared. I mean, that's what I love about researching these subcultures is that they've got, I love the book, The Orchid Thief, which is, mm-hmm. you know, even though I don't really care about flowers, but just reading about the passion of this subculture. And that's what I love about the Jigsaw. They've got their opening. They've got their trays. And the Rubik's Cube people, the teenagers who solve it in 3.5 seconds, they're crazy. They've got Rubik's lubrication.
I was of the age where the big thing was to take it apart and put Vaseline inside. That was what we did.
Right.
When it came
now
out. I used to be able to solve the Rubik's Cube. I think
Good
I've
for
forgotten
you.
Some of the, I know the basic ones, like how you get the middle pieces. You know, I had the weirdest experience of muscle memory with a Rubik's Cube. We hadn't had a Rubik's Cube for a long time, and I got one for one of my kids years ago. And I realized I hadn't lost the muscle memory of how to get the corner pieces and how to get the middle side pieces.
That is great. That
Isn't
must
that
have
weird?
Felt good. Yeah.
Well, I think it means that I worked on it too much when I was like 13 or whatever age I was. Because if you've got muscle memory for how to solve particular spots, that's a problem. I promised you I would talk about this, but you talk about a corn maze in Vermont in your book, which I was so excited when I came to that chapter, and I immediately yelled for my son, Ben. Ben, as you know, this is for our listener, is no stranger to A.J. Jacobs' work. He's a big fan. And when he was younger, and I think I may have to include a picture in the show notes, because Ben decided just for fun to take the guidance, to take A.J.'s rules of living biblically, literally, and he, for about a week, I think, wore a robe and carried a staff and wore sandals and did the year. He did a week of living week. Biblically. And I have pictures.
You sent me one picture. And one of my favorite little life hacks to make my life better is that on my computer, my screensaver is a rotation of thousands of photos.
Yeah.
So Ben, in his biblical robe, comes up, I'd say, once every week and a half.
Oh, that's cool.
So funny. I love it.
That is so funny. So Ben, every single year, he ran cross country, and every single year, a tradition for the St. Johnsbury Academy cross country team was to go to the corn maze in Danville. And run it, and hours, and of course they're expected to run the whole time.
Wow.
The expectation is that they it's a training exercise, and it's a fun training exercise, and they're supposed to run the entire time there.
That's hardcore.
And you were in there for like 4 hours.
I was stuck in there for 4 hours. Yeah. I mean, it was fascinating because I tried to find the hardest corn maze in the world, and this is probably it. because when I called the owner, he was just so entertaining. I knew I had to go because he's
hardcore.
Yeah. He's like, oh, yeah, people burst into tears. Couples break up. We had a father who abandoned his family and drove off. And I said, can I bring my son? He's like, how old is he? And I said, 13. No, don't bring him because he'll just get too frustrated. So I was like, I'm in. This sounds amazing. And so I am super impressed with Ben that he was able to not just
do it. Well, and it was fun because the whole team, you know, the whole team doing it together. So there's some collaboration work in there. Not that that helps you very much in there, I would think. What would be funny is if, like, I can't remember how tall it is, but if, like, people go in there with step ladders.
Yes. Well, people try to cheat all the time in every. So there are people with drones who try to look at it from above and hack it that way. But one of the big themes of the book is flexible thinking, which is actually I think hugely applicable to writing. But the guy who oversees the maze, he stands on a platform above it, sort of like a Greek god and judging the mortals. But he says the least flexible people are teenage boys, that they'll go down a corridor, hit a wall, and then keep banging their head against the wall and not able to be flexible.
That is not surprising to me at all.
Yes, but I see Ben as being an exception to that rule.
That's interesting. Well, there is this sort of just need to be right. I'm going to make it work.
Well, that to me is one of the big things. That was like a huge lesson. Is one of my favorite facts I learned in this whole research was the idea of apophenia, which is when you see a pattern where there is none, where you see like the face of the Virgin Mary in a French toast. I mean, maybe she is there, but assuming she isn't. And it's what people get stuck on something and they just won't let it go. And that's bad in puzzles, but I think it's bad in life. And it explains phenomena like QAnon is basically apophenia.
It explains problems with writing certain drafts. Like, you know, KJ and I were talking about this recently. Like she had to have this one plot point or character or whatever. And you keep going with it because you have to make it work. You've fallen in love with this particular darling and you're just going to make it work until you realize that unless you get rid of that in your writing, you're never going to solve that problem with that chapter.
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, I have to say one of my greatest joys while writing this book was talking. My kids are old enough that they can talk about it. So I took my son out to lunch and I said, I'm struggling with this final chapter. I want it to be, you know, the five big life lessons that I learned from puzzles. And he's like, I don't know, that doesn't sound that interesting. And it rocked my world. I'm like, you know what? Maybe he's right. That's too didactic. So I was able to end with something that's much more organic about this infinite puzzle that the family did together. But he's the one who jolted me out of this the stubbornness that it had to end that way.
Yeah. Well, I think if you do a lot of journalism, we unfortunately get stuck in that, like, six big things that blah, 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 or five lessons I learned from. Because, you know, frankly, it's an easy way to do an elevator pitch for a book. Like, what is your book about? And when you get to that place where you're like, oh, it's too complicated. But you have a great, the elevator pitch for this book is just, you know, essentially what I learned from why we love puzzles so much and what they're all about. And I think it's fantastic. The fact, every once in a while, a book comes out and I'm like, has this book not already been written? Because it's such a great metaphor for, I don't know.
Thrilled that you wrote it. I have to say, I'm slightly, I'm always paranoid that someone's going to scoop me. And so,
The longer that first proposal of mine sits out there, the more likely it is that someone else is going to write it. And I've been scooped on pieces before, and the exquisite agony of being scooped on something that you've dumped a lot of research time into, and you know that your editors are going to say, but didn't you see that piece that just came out?
Yeah.
So that's not, but at least with a book, you can put your spin on, like, your perspective on
that's true.
And at least there's that possibility. So, right. I have to tell you, my new favorite word is, and I don't know how to pronounce it, is chorizont. Chorizant? Oh, yeah.
I think it is Chorizant. I looked at, yes, okay. It's Chorizant. So I'm so glad you love that word.
This is a word I am going to fit into, as a former Latin teacher, this is a word that I'm going to fit into my my lexicon and force it into sentences here and there. But a Chorizant, will you please enlighten us, AJ?
Yes, I agree. It's one of my favorite. A Chorizant is someone who believes that the Iliad and the Odyssey were written by two different people, that it was not just Homer. And just the fact right. that there is a word for that just makes me so gleeful. And that is, a lot of the book is about word nerdery and how much I love weird words. And to me, that is one of the top five I've ever heard.
There's a Serena Bowen, our co-host, has also written a YA novel. And well, actually, she likes to fit word nerdery into a bunch of her books. But there's this one in particular, the book called The Accidentals, which is mostly the themes in there about music. But the newly reacquainted father-daughter duo in that book, it becomes their thing to come up with words that don't have a word that's a negative that doesn't have a positive equivalent. And I've forgotten
inept.
The word for it, right?
Inept yes. is one.
Yeah. Yeah, so you can't be, yeah. Anyway, so throughout that whole book, the characters are constantly like peppering the dialogue with those things. And it just, as a word nerd myself, makes me so happy.
I'm going to read
makes
that
me
book.
So happy.
What's it called? The Accidentals?
I'll send you a copy. It's called The Accidentals. I think I have an extra copy floating around. I'll send it to you. It's a delightful book. So my agent told me after I wrote Gift of Failure, she said, now I want to warn you, be really, really patient. The first book is usually the thing that feels really easy to come up with because it's the idea that you have been, that's been stewing around in your brain for a while. And then like what the next thing is can be a lot harder because you have to be struck by inspiration and you have to be struck by a question that no one else has answered or a question that no one else has addressed. How do you go about switching your thinking from something like the puzzler and then just being on the lookout for the next thing? Like, how are you on the lookout for the next thing? What's your process for looking for the next thing? Because your books are all so different, yet all similar in the sense that they have a similar narrative structure about like, I'm going to learn how to do this
right.
thing or how to be this thing.
Well, I love that question because I do think about it a lot. And I'll give you a couple of different strategies I use. One is that I actually, every morning, I do spend 15 minutes just brainstorming using, I know that KJ uses it, the remarkable tablet. I'm not getting it could be just random, sort of stream of consciousness, but sometimes I'll like, you know, I'm going to come up with five book ideas. I'm almost certain that none of them are going to be good, but I got to keep that muscle going. So that's one way. Another way is always looking around your life, because a lot of these books have just come from my life. The first book where I read the encyclopedia was because my father had started to read the encyclopedia when I was a kid, but he gave up around the letter B, like Borneo or so. And you are so good at this, Jess, of looking around your life and coming up with, especially as a teacher, you came up with amazing, I heard you talk about.
It's a little annoying. I have a lot of conversation with my husband, which is like, is this a thing? Could I write? I feel a little bit like when in Sex and the City, Carrie Bradshaw got to the end of sort of her inspiration and she's like, socks, is that the sock drawer? Is that a thing? Can I write about socks?
Well, I don't think you've come to the socks level yet. I think you're doing just fine. This is not a book, but this was an article. I wrote a Facebook post at the beginning of the year about how my fitness goal for the year, I had gotten bored of trying the 10,000 steps. So, as you might remember from my health book, I do a lot of my work on a treadmill desk. So I'm always, and the treadmill desk is at an angle, pointed up like a hill. And the treadmill keeps track of my vertical feet, not just my horizontal feet.
Nice.
So I go about the length, the height of the Eiffel Tower every day. And I said, this is more fun to try to, and I figured out space begins at 330,000 feet. So if I walked every day, I could walk to space. And I was like, this is fun. So I put it on Facebook, and it got so much fun traction, and so we formed our own space walkers group. So there are 30 people. And I was like, you know what? This would make a fun article. Like, I didn't intend it to be an article when I first put it out. It was just like a little idea I had. So always being aware. I forget which writer talked about it, but always almost having a second head on your shoulder while you live your life, saying, would this be an interesting article?
I think it all comes down to curiosity. I think the fact that we like to ask questions around the world. And I also think noticing things is a big thing for me. Like, I like seeing, I like noticing, I like learning. And I think that's how ideas continue to flow.
Those are
being
two,
a critical thinker. Yeah.
All three of those. Yeah. And curiosity is one of the main, I think curiosity and gratitude are two of my favorite emotions. And what sort of the mantra of the puzzler is, don't get furious, get curious. Like, so when you're faced with a problem, you're actually gonna solve it. If you get angry, it's gonna be harder to solve because your brain goes into the sort of tunnel vision. So
yeah.
Get curious. So,
you know, stress is the thing that causes our brains to shut, the learning parts of our brains to shut down. So like, that's the thinking behind keeping as calm and stress-free of a classroom as possible, is because if you really want your students to learn something, taking the stress out. So like, that's why timing math fact sets is one of the worst things you can do for learning, because speed is not the same thing as mastery. And actually the speed for a lot of kids will shut down their ability to actually process, not just not faster, but at all. So taking the stress out of the learning process tends to help anyway.
That is great.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. It's all of this. I hope anyway that, you know, I can keep this job of just being curious. But I always say this, my job is to get curious about something, to find answers, and just be a translator for the people that don't want to do the dive as deeply as I like to do it, which is pretty I think also as a teacher, I like to be able to see, you know, the 1,000-mile high view, and especially if I'm teaching in a classroom, I have to anticipate I like to know something to the point where if I can, so that a middle schooler could ask just about any question and I would at least have a way to think about it. And middle schoolers can have really crazy thoughts.
Yeah, I imagine.
So, yeah, yeah. So
well,
I like becoming the expert.
I am with you. Yeah. I mean, that is my favorite part. My job as a writer, I feel, is sort of threefold. One is the research, and the other is actually sitting alone and typing the words. And then the last part is getting the word out, going on your show. And I love those two, the front and the back. I do not like the middle. And you've had plenty of people on the show talk about this, but I just find it being alone and lonely and solid, and you don't get any immediate feedback. Yeah, that I am so happy for the other two parts, because otherwise I would have chosen the worst job in the world.
But
I feel almost like I chose one of the best, because I'm lucky to be able to explore these fascinating topics.
Yeah. I have to ask if you made yourself giggle when you came up with the fact that you make da-da jokes. Not just dad jokes, but da-da jokes. Come on, you had to have made yourself giggle.
Well, it's funny you say that, because I do sometimes, I don't laugh out loud, but I can feel like in the back of my brain, I'm like, if I, you know, if someone else said that, I might laugh. And I find it a very useful sort of way to judge if something works.
Yeah.
And I was friends with a guy who worked on The Daily Show. And he said one of his secrets to writing humor was to surprise himself, which I loved, because it's kind of makes no sense. How can you surprise yourself? But I think if you work at it, you kind of can surprise yourself. You can.
Yeah. Stephen King says the same thing. He's like, if I'm not surprised by where the book is going, I can't really hope to surprise the reader.
Interesting. I didn't know he said that.
I think it's in On Writing. I'm not sure. Anyway. I read that book all the time, as I have talked about a bajillion
times. I know. I'm gonna. That's a great hack. I'm gonna start doing that more, like to get into the mood of. I liked what you said about listening or watching All the President's Men. Was that you or KJ?
Yeah, I said that. Yeah, I love that.
That was hilarious. Yeah. So
I actually got really inspired last night. We went to go see here in Burlington. I saw Hasan Minhaj, the comedian and former Daily Show person, and he really surprised me last night in a way that was very inspiring. It got me thinking about the way I produce my end material, whatever that is. And he's a comedian slash storyteller, and I love when those two things are melded together. It's really, really quite excellent. Well, we have gone so over, like this is like a super long podcast. So thank you if you're still here all the way to the end. AJ, where can people find you?
Well, the usual places, my website is ajjacobs.com. So no shock there. And the book's called The Puzzler, and it's available in all indie bookstores and non-indie bookstores. And I love to hear, that is one thing, I do love to hear from readers. And I get a lot of ideas for my following books. So please send me ideas of what you want to see me subject.
Where could people do that? Where in particular do you like it when people get to you?
I mean, my website has my email, which goes directly to me, but Twitter or Facebook, anything like that.
All right. Cool. And I just highly recommend that you read AJ's books, because for me anyway, they've been inspiring. They've made me want to be a better researcher, writer. They make me more curious. And I'm just really grateful
Thank you, AJ, Jess. And I'll tell you, your first book, The Gift of Failure, was in my mind while I was writing this book all the time. So thank you for that.
We talk on this podcast a lot about books, that having a pile of books on the desk that are in the shape or the style or the voice of things that you're trying to get across, and yours are often in my piles, depending on like what I'm working on, what voice I'm going for. I really love what you do, and I'm grateful you're out there doing
it. Thank you. I'm grateful you're out there too.
Oh, so sweet. All right, everyone, until next week, keep your butts in the chair and your head in the game. Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work. Save. Pause.